Welcome to the Real Triathlon Podcast. I'm your host, Garrick Lowen, here with Nicholas Chase and Jackson Lund.
Welcome back to the Real Triathlon Podcast. We are here with the legendary Nicholas Chase, and he is legendary even more than before because he just completed a 100K ultra event in some crazy terrain. We'll get to that in a minute. Today's episode, we are going to be interviewing Barry Shepley of the C3 Triathlon Club, Canadian Cross Training Club, as they're called. He has created a really cool series that is going on right now with small numbers and basically one of the only triathlons that's happening in the world right now, probably. And so we're going to chat with him about that and how he got into the sport. He's done a lot of cool things. But first, Nick Chase, are you able to walk yet 9 days or 8 days after your ultra? And tell us about the race.
Well, holy cow. I think I just did my second run today. So this is Monday. We're recording, and I raced two Saturdays ago. So, yeah, good amount of time to get your life back in order, put the glue things, stick them back in place, and hope that they're going to start to recover. But holy cow, I think, 100K ultra probably doesn't sound as epic as it probably – it doesn't sum it up as well, but this particular race was it's in the Tusher mountain range. Covers about 20,000 feet of elevation over three massive peaks, and the elevation that you're probably the average of what you're running at is about 8,800 to 9,000, with the highest peak being 12,100 and the lowest spot being about 7,800. So pretty much a ripper of a day, like exhaustion, wanting to quit, questioning life. I think I was in sixth place until maybe even eighth place until mile 30. And then I just wanted to throw myself off the side of this peak. It was called Copper Belt, I think. And it was basically picture just this peak in the middle of nowhere. And all it's tan because all it is, it's totally exposed. There's no trees on this peak. And it's just like a swirl of trail going around the side of it on this loose shale. Like on the video I posted on Instagram, you can see it pretty well. I posted it actually on our YouTube channel for the Real Triathlon Podcast, so you can see the emotional degradation of my life. But yeah, thanks for asking, Jack. It was something I'll never remember. I don't remember a lot of it, but I'll never forget it is what I do remember. just all my runs now feel like short, really short. I think it took me 17 hours or 16 hours, 40 minutes to do 61 miles or something like that with about, my watch said about 19 or 20,000 feet. So that was my day, buddy.
Yeah, I really couldn't believe it when basically what that adds up to is 5,100 meters of elevation in 100 kilometers. So 5.1 kilometers in 100 kilometers. So the same as if you had just gone up a 5% gradient the entire time, that's how much gain you did. And you also were going down up like rocky terrain. Like that couldn't have been harder. Like I can't even imagine doing that. It's just ridiculous.
Athletes who compete at this level.
Yeah. When you first ran like almost a week later, you still feel that in your legs?
Actually, not really. I think, excuse me. I think I did so much riding last week just cause it felt good. And then, I mean, I think I did 13 hours of riding in the last 3 days just to kind of keep going. I did a lot of gravel stuff, just fun. Like once your legs are wrecked and you can't run, you've got to really stick to the bike and make it less painful when you can still go places and burn some calories, have some fun, check the boxes off. Because none of us, like if I told you, you got to sit still and rest for a week, you'd probably have a hard time. So you just try to keep moving. My legs actually feel great. So keep in mind, like since it is so long and so much vertical, of course the downhill, it adds up and it hurts like a mother. I can't even, like once I crested the last peak, I had been hiking for like 2.5 hours straight up. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to run again. Like I can't even fathom going downhill. So you have to really give into the terrain and let gravity pull you down. And once you start running with a little bit more of a high heel recovery and taking some of the impact off the quads, it starts to feel a little better. But I had trekking poles, and I couldn't have done this without trekking poles. I had lightweight carbon fiber trekking poles. I had a really lightweight hydration vest from UltraSpire. The hardest thing was planning water and nutrition stops, because sometimes there were 7 or 8 miles between the nutrition stops. But you're like, okay, I've got 2 big bottles of water, I'll be all right. But then some of it takes 2.5-3 hours because you're going up maybe 3,500-4,000 feet at 20%. So it's just a hard negotiation of terrain. I slipped and fell. My buddy face planted and
oh my god,
hurt his ribs.
Did he finish?
Oh yeah, of course he finished. He's the one who got me into this thing. He was like, but he told me, I think 6 months ago about this, because I was like, we're trying to negotiate races. And he was like, well, 1 August, you've got 100K you could do. And I was like, I'm going to be doing 70.3 Boulder. Sorry about that. I'll be doing 70.3 Boulder. So I'm not going to be doing any ultra marathons yet, you idiot. Like, and then after spending a couple of weeks up there, actually, I've spent like probably about a month and a half up there at altitude. And you just like, it's addicting terrain. There's mountain goats everywhere. There's running water, there's streams. You just like douse your whole body in cold, clean water. It's just really inspiring terrain. So once you're up there and you see these peaks, and bear in mind, we've got like a list of 6 challenges we're going to do up there. One of the challenges this weekend is a gravel triathlon that we're going to do on the original gravel race for the USA. It's called the Crusher and the Tusher. So we're going to do a gravel bike triathlon this weekend to kind of start the next challenge. And then we've got 5 other peaks we want to hit in one day on running too. So dude, with COVID happening, like what else am I going to do? I've got to find some epic stuff to do and kill myself.
Honestly. Well, just training, racing in that terrain sounds like kind of like a different experience, like a battle with nature almost. It's just throwing everything at you. Got the slopes, you got, well, the gradients, not to mention at altitude, that makes it even harder. And it's probably dry. I think I saw in your post-race video, like it was hot at times, obviously. Like it's just crushing you in every way it possibly can. So that's pretty tough for sure. And it's a totally different thing from triathlon. I mean, like being a good swimmer probably doesn't help you too much with that. But I bet you the strength on the bike helps with powering up those mountains.
It kind of did. Like on the really steep stuff, I was overtaking people. But on the moderate grades of like, you know, 8-12%, I managed to link up with a couple guys over the course of this run. Cause you're out there for so long, you got to like make some chat going on. So a dude I was going with, he's probably like in his mid-20s. He did 172 miler. He was raising money for Alzheimer's, and he did it in Tahoe, and he had heat exhaustion and had a tough time. And this was like 2 months prior to this race. So he was taking it easy. But what I noticed is the technique of power hiking. It's like almost speed walking with trekking poles uphill. And that's where my quads and legs didn't have the turnover of quick walking. So that was really tough. Like I was like, man, these freaking trunks of cycling legs are not helping me move up the really moderate stuff. The steep stuff I could really dig in and propel myself. But anyways, guess what? That guy pulled away from me at mile 36, but then he was like dead at mile 52 at the aid station, and I struck down by him. So it's anything can happen out there.
That's crazy, man. Well, I would like to say you inspired me. You didn't inspire me to do that, however, you did kind of give me a whole new respect for what suffering means. So that's pretty cool. Are you going to do another ultra? Are you in for it? Is this a lifetime thing for you now?
No way, man. I think trail running is like a new love for sure, just because you can really become like whoever you want to be out there in the trail. And you just being away from people is so nice. That's the beauty about being up at that altitude, is not a lot of people are out there. And then like after being up there for a week, when I have to come down the canyon again to like get groceries, I'm like, man, it's weird. And then coming back to St. George to the desert, it's just surreal to have within a 2-hour drive. It only takes me 2 hours to get there, to have a 2-hour drive to my buddy's place where he graciously lets me, you know, train. We just get such a switch environment, but it's just inspiring to be out there. And I wouldn't say that like this is my new shtick. Like, I just did this to see if I could do it. I've read a lot of books about ultras, and like all these guys and girls talk about just putting yourself to the ultimate test to see what you're made of, and you know, riding the line between psychotic and capability is pretty telling. Like, I think this is going to translate to Ironman St. George, just because I just don't care about the pain anymore. I've had so much worse. This is hopefully an Ironman is not as hard as 100K ultra at that altitude.
No kidding. I mean, that was basically twice as long pretty well. So that's crazy in itself, but Ironman St. George. So you think that race is going to happen? What's the inside info on that?
Well, I don't want to get too optimistic. I'd say it's still a 50-50 sweep. However, I know the permits are good. And Ironman, of course, does want it to happen because they need races. We need a proof of concept race to show that we can do this. We need a proof of concept to show that we can have a race and keep it safe and keep everyone, you know, within the same vicinity and not get COVID. I will say though, I did get you might have got this if you signed up for 70.3 Cozumel, but I've signed up for Ironman Cozumel, and they sent me a secondary waiver that I had to sign. It was like a COVID waiver. So I think Ironman is going to start sending out COVID waivers for every race. And I think that's a good sign. It's going to put the responsibility on us to get ourselves there and safely take care of each other. So I think St. George is 50-50. Anything can happen any minute.
Yeah, actually I didn't sign up for Cozumel, but I did get a waiver for 70.3 Monterey, which is the same day as St. George. And yeah, it's a COVID waiver. And I think they kind of had to go through that transition of taking the liability off of Ironman for it in order for races to happen. So now Ironman's not worried. It's more, are the local authorities going to allow it? Is the governor going to allow it? I'm going to just go on a limb and say that the Mexico race is more likely just because it's Mexico.
I agree.
And they were the last place to allow a race. It only makes sense that they're going to be the first place to allow one again. That being said, haven't fully decided whether I want to go or not. I've kind of got to leave options open as it approaches with, you know, what are the case numbers like there? Is it going to be safe? Do I think they have good protocols in place? What's my quarantine like when I get home? All those things. So it's a bit of a tough season in that way. You can't choose things too far in advance, but, hoping that options start to open up at least. And I hope you're right about Ironman St. George, because man, you long distance boys need a race too. Probably a little bit just by chance that the schedule is lining up that it looks like full Ironman will be the first one to go. But either way, if that one doesn't go, there's other options in September that are supposed to be on, like 70.3 Augusta. So hopefully something in the near future happens.
Well, dude, I've got a buddy who went to Mexico, and he's like, they are not messing around when it comes to COVID. Like, they've got temperature checks almost everywhere. And they've got dudes with guns, you know, preventing people from going into places who are not allowed. Like, they're not messing around. They know that tourism is their, like, that's their bread and butter. So if they can figure out how to do it and just like by pure force and like guns keep people from going places who shouldn't be there. Like, I guess I give them a pretty good chance. Like, I'm hoping to go to, if things work out for the rest of the season, you know, it'd be great. I don't know what's up in October yet, but for sure St. George, and then end of September, 70.3 Cozumel is an option as well. And then Cabo is November, and then full Ironman at the end of November. And then I might go do Patagon Extreme Try, just if Chile is opening their borders, excuse me.
Nice. Well, let's hope no more cancellations. Screw that. We've had enough. Let's hope that cases keep coming down, things get safer and safer, and we can move along. Now, we should get into this awesome interview that I did with Barry Shepley. He's a legend in the sport. He's been in it for years, and can't wait for you guys to hear how he kind of came up through the sport and how things have changed over the years in triathlon and how they're coming back full circle to the way things began in the beginning. So without further ado, Here she is with Barry Shepley. I'm here with Barry Shepley, a triathlon legend here in Canada and internationally. He's had some amazing experiences in the sport, been around since pretty much since the sport started for Canada, and I'm really excited to chat with Barry. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Pleasure to be a part of your show.
Awesome. So I was just saying to Barry right before we started recording here, he's been in the sport since I don't even know when. So I'm just going to ask that first, Barry. How did you even find the sport of triathlon, and what was your beginning with the sport?
Well, ironically, I started in 1979. So you were not even a thought process those many, many years ago. I was 16. And in a small town of 2000, which is now much more famous because one of your racing colleagues, Lionel Sanders, comes from the same town of 2000 down in southern Ontario, had the opportunity to just, in a small town, you can do things that you probably can't do in big cities. And we lived on Lake Erie, which was a great place to do some swimming. And at 16, I started putting on triathlons, believe it or not, milk jugs over a sandbar, and you would do four laps around. If you had to walk, you could walk. It was only 4 feet deep where the sandbar was. So for safety reasons, that was our lifeguard. You did a 30-kilometer ride down towards Oxley and past the golf course back, and then a 5 or 6 kilometer run around. And that started things literally, so 40 years ago at this point plus. And the opportunity to be a race director was a really important thing because I realized how important events were, because those three races we would put on every summer started to attract 40 people, 60 people, 80 people. And my dad had a small restaurant, so he would cater the thing absolutely free. And by the end of the summer, suddenly there's 100 people who got exposed to triathlon who had never done one before. So I saw the joy in people 4 decades ago. This is before ITU ever existed, before Triathlon Canada ever existed. And as I headed off to McMaster University, one day I was trying to find out where exactly was, the races. There was no internet at that time. You couldn't kind of just go on the line and sign up. So I was trying to find some hard copies to sign up for the Kingston Triathlon and a couple other events. And when I called the office, they said, well, there is no Triathlon Ontario. You know, there's Swim Ontario, there's hockey, there's volleyball, but no Triathlon Ontario. And I had a world-class professor at McMaster University, Frank Hayden, who's much more famous for having started the Special Olympics. And he challenged me to start a triathlon federation. So I wrote a paper for one of his admin classes at McMaster. And that paper became essentially the formation of Triathlon Ontario. So within a year and a half, the federation began. It was my residence room, Edwards Hall at McMaster University. And when you called the hotline, it was my outgoing telephone line from residence. And for the first couple of years, you know, people like Steve Fleck and all of those names that you still hear around were young athletes that were starting to race. Kevin McKinnon was new on the scene. And I can go down the list of guys who are now in their 50s and 60s, but they were the pros of that era. And so very proud to have got Triathlon Ontario started. I was the founding president and some great people back in that era who put a lot of time to get it off the ground. And just so happened within about 2 years, this superstar, brilliant race organizer called Graham Fraser comes along in Ontario. And so my other part of my life began at that event, which was Graham needed someone to do some commentating at his event. And so he had hired a professional DJ who basically had a great voice and knew nothing about triathlon. So I'd stand next to the guy, feed him information about who's Augie Marmello and who's Vince Beretta and who's Dan Murray. And about the third race, the guy never showed up, and Graham, you know, begged me if I would announce. So that was the start. And for about 6 years, all of my announcing were live races at his events, all the way from Orillia to you name what was in the series back at that time. So I had a great opportunity to watch some of the best in the world at that time. And Graham was bringing guys like Mike Pigg and, you know, Mark Allen and all these names that we hear of now that were legends. And back then they were the best pros in the world coming to Milton to race in the Reebok triathlon and some of the other big events that Graham was putting on. If you see those old pictures, we hosted the 1991 Worlds up in Muskoka. I did the live commentary at the venue, you know, that day where Simon Lessing won and McKillie Jones won their first world title. So I had this unique opportunity in my own backyard, but it began just from literally putting a little triathlon with milk jugs in my backyard. I continued to coach, eventually I was lucky enough to kind of move into the national team coaching position for a decade, and met Simon. And I met Simon Whitfield through the oddest of ways. When I was president, I was concerned. If you take a look at an average race, you see all these 30 and 40 and 50 year olds, and you see no kids. And yeah. I'm saying, you know, swimming has a million kids and a few old people who keep swimming. A million hockey players that are all 10, 11, 12, but a few old masters. We had all kinds of old people, you know, when I say old, 30, 40, 50, 60, but no kids. And so I was concerned from the logistics and just the demographics that if this sport starts losing the older people, where is the new generation coming in? So I was lucky enough, I was working on an assembly line in Chrysler in the middle of the summers between university, too much time on my hands, only thinking about triathlon. And I was the president and I said, you know what, Iron Man, Kids of Steel. So I was formulated this probably over 2 weeks working on the assembly line. Eventually, yeah. I found a company in Toronto, convinced them to sponsor it. It was called Triathlon Leasing. I knew nothing about them. In the end, they had nothing to do with triathlon. They had three companies that they leased products for. So that was it. But by the end of about an hour and a half in the vice president's office, I convinced her that they should sponsor my Kids of Steel series. It didn't exist. It was all in my head. And so she said, you know what? I want to see one of those races. So yeah. Now I'm panicking. I got to show her some product. So I said, well, there's a race on Friday at McMaster. This is Monday. I'm so broke. I don't have a car. I'm driving. I'm on the GO bus to Toronto. So I get back to McMaster and I go to the guy who ran the summer camp of 400 kids at Mac. And I said, I need all 400 kids on Friday doing a Kids of Steel race. He said, what's that? I said, just let me talk to the kids. You bring a mountain bike, you bring, you know, whatever. So the kids, some did relays, some did the whole race. Vice presidents pulled up. They loved what they saw and they signed the check on Monday. And we got a van with a big Kids of Steel logo on it, 5,000 t-shirts, 5,000 medals, 5,000 balloons and certificates. And I called everyone I knew in the entire province and said, I'm coming to your town. Can you get a lake, a pool, whatever, a river, and we're going to do a race in your area. And there happened to be a family from Kingston called the Hollywoods, and they were next door neighbors to Simon Whitfield. They had a cottage up in Charbot Lake. And so they said, we'll put one on at our cottage. So I drive up with a van to Charbot Lake for 110 kids. And one of those kids happened to be Simon Whitfield, who for the next 34 years of his life, we've kind of been in and out, you know, between athlete coach, between Olympics, between commentary. So Simon set a big tone for this whole country, but you know, he would tell you that Kids of Steel set the tone for him as a lifestyle, something his parents loved. They would go every other weekend to a kids race and have a little barbecue after at the park, wherever it was. And that kind of set the tone for his, you know, next three decades of his life.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's that story of you starting a race 5 days or 4 days after you basically just made it up. It's pretty crazy how much the sport has changed from being so grassroots at that point to now, I guess, at least pre-COVID, what we would call this massive, massive thing where like nobody knows of a triathlon that's less than like a couple hundred people. And that's considered a grassroots race. And then the real big races are the Ironmans, and they're like thousands of people. So what I've seen, and now that we have kind of, you know, COVID going on, is you've gone back to those basically a upgraded version of that milk jug race you put on in Lake Erie, because that's all we can do now is just small group things that are simple. You know, there's not enough people. You can't afford to close roads for a day when you only have eight people racing. It just doesn't work. So what are you doing now with the C3 old school series, and how, you know, what is it like, or how is it similar to what you did way back when you were?
It's ironic that it's not much off of four decades ago. For your listeners, one of the things that we ran into early in the spring, started to see, you know, cancellation after cancellation. And then, you know, many of my young athletes were focused on Edmonton and the World Junior Championship. Suddenly that thing got taken away from them. And so you start to see disappointment, you know, in athletes in of age group and all the way down to the juniors, thinking like, you know, do I really need to go push that hard interval workout today? Or, you know, why am I kind of doing this, you know, dry land session if I don't have my race in the next 2, 3, 4 months? So the board and I sat down and said, look, we're in a position of leadership. We have some resources of the quarry, and we can go out and seek out some spaces to maybe put on some events. They're certainly not going to be lucrative, and they're going to be hugely time consuming, because we're going to have to do this same thing two or three times a week to get through, you know, a modest number of people, but to do it safely, social distancing and all of those kinds of things. So what we did was essentially, we've got two different courses, one's hilly and one's more technical. We picked two or three distances, a sprint, an Olympic, and a long course, kind of 2, 55, 54 actually, and 15. And those are done over either Wednesday, Friday, or Sunday. So you pick the day of the week that you want to race. And we get you in the morning, you do the swim at our quarry, and then we have the bike and run at a different location. That way we don't have to shut down any major roads. We can do it inexpensively. It's time consuming, but it's also gratifying to see people smiling, you know, coming off the bike, and they haven't done this for 6, 8, 10 months, didn't think they were going to be doing it, and in having the opportunity. So, you know, I saw the same smiles on your face and Cody's face and Taylor and you know, and Andrew Bolton and Mikkel and so forth, Tamara, that I see with the first time age groupers coming out to our venue and racing. So, you know, do you really need a big t-shirt? It's nice. Do you need the big meal? It's awesome. But, you know, the real joy is kind of coming off and running down one of your pals. We've got 5 or 6 guys. You know, Hans Porten is very famous in Ontario, along with 4 or 5 of these guys in the 45 to 55 and 60 category. And they literally pick the same day each week, whatever it is. They all say, okay, I'm taking the morning off to come race.
Yeah,
and literally I see them pounding, you know, down the last kilometer of the run. And it's like the world championships, you know, you don't always have to have a big crowd there. I mean, you just see what it was like 40 years ago when guys would get together and put their bike up against a tree and come off and they're going to run around the lake and, you know, first guy back kind of wins. So it's a little more organized than that, but it's the same sentiment as that flavor so many years ago. And it was ironic, you know, the day I should have been at the Olympic Games in July announcing the women's race, I'm putting on a kid's triathlon that, you know, are 11 and 12 and 13 years of age and don't know any of the people who are at the Sydney Olympic Games, but they're having the same fun as if, you know, I was in Tokyo. So I said, you know what, I got into this sport because of the love of multi-sport, to see the smile on people's faces. And I'm just going to put my own personal disappointment of not being in Tokyo away, because it's really quite minor in the big picture. Here we are, we've got this great place to train, we're in a healthy country. You know, we've got a lot of things to be very, you know, happy about. And it's summertime, it's sunny, let's go out there and suck it up and enjoy this. And so I've really kind of put that disappointment behind me. But seeing the joy of other people racing is really what it was from the beginning. And it's like I'm having some of the best fun I've had in decades, even though we, you know, I haven't left the county. I don't think I've got more than about 25 kilometers from my house all summer.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you said it, like, we, you know, we had the pro race there that you put on, and you got the Nouveau Iron to put up a pro prize purse. And, you know, Nouveau Iron, and this is one thing that C3 and Barry Shepley are like notoriously good for, is like finding a way to get the community to get involved in the sport when this is a company that makes fences, iron fences, I believe. Yeah. So obviously, you know, they don't make something for triathlon. A sponsor doesn't have to be, you know, a running shoe company. And they've put up, you know, some money for us to be able to race and continue to pursue our goals. So it was super fun. And he says it's a 54K bike course and it's hilly. It's like brutally hard. I'm telling you guys, it's the hardest course I've done in years. It's amazing.
Well, that record, your record's going to stand for a very, very long time. When some of the age groupers, you know, saw the time, they wanted to know if you had only done 2 of the laps, not all 3 of the 18 kilometer laps. But I'd like to put a challenge out, you know, to many of your viewers, whether they're in Ontario or in the rest of Canada or the United States, Australia, other countries. You know, I think that if you love the sport and you're in a position to make some contribution, then I think we all have a responsibility at this time to kind of pull together and, you know what, put a few bucks up. You know, 6 lawyers, 5 dentists that are in, you know, Quebec or in Alberta or in a state, you know, in whatever, in Texas, put up a race prize purse so those local people, those pros that inspire us, like yourself, like Cody, like Taylor and others, have a chance to do 2 things. Make a bit of money that's desperately needed under these circumstances right now. And also just to go out and lay it down and have some fun. And you don't need to have everything out that's helicopters and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, we created a great video out of the day.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And I think, you know, I challenge other people out there to say, you know what, this is our time. If you're a race director, if you're five or six people that can just put some energy together and put on a race and put $3,000 or $4,000 together as a prize purse for the day, whatever that might look like, give the local pros in your province or your state or your juniors an opportunity to race and to pick up a bit of coin and to kind of, you know, you guys inspired all my juniors. Like, they were out there volunteering and they're like, oh my God, did you see how fast Tamara ran? You know, like, there's Taylor Reed, who wasn't a swimmer 8 years ago, and he leads out of the water. Wasn't that awesome? So you guys don't always understand how much you inspire others. And I think every province and every part in the province across the country need to kind of just man up and put on a race. You know, even though they're going to lose some money on it, it's to help the sport continue to thrive in a tough year.
Yeah, I hear you. I think it's, you know, this year, that's the way races are going to happen. And it's people like you that are needed to make these things happen and put it together. And a lot of countries are in a good position now with their numbers, but they're also hesitant. Oh, we don't want a bunch of people coming in. We don't want thousands of people racing, which is understandable. And, you know, just like you said, those little races can really turn somebody's summer around. It turned, you know, mine around. Like, I was doing some of those Zwift racing and stuff, and that's fun, but you want to race and you want to race your friends. And it just really revitalized my training. So,
well, we got some young boys that want to take a piece out of you next weekend.
Oh man, that's going to be hard.
And that's great. You're taking you out of your comfort zone. But I remember you doing this format up in Collingwood with Taylor and Von Bechtel and that bunch of athletes, you know, about Simon Whitfield was involved with Grant Fraser's event. So, you know, you're going back to some of your roots. So I know you know how to ride a bike fast around corners, and you'll have a chance to do that next Saturday.
I'm going to have to prove my all-around abilities on the bike this time by getting the old road bike out. So it should be fun. But, it's going to be awesome. And the other thing I want to touch on, so you've seen the sport, probably I'm assuming followed the elite level all the way through, and that's been, you know, part of your passion in the sport. How have you seen it change over the last decades? And, you know, has it changed for the better, for the worse? Like, what's your opinion there? And, you know, what do you think is going to come out of this COVID thing once it's all said and done? Do you think there's going to be lasting effects from that on the pro side and the age group side?
Yeah. So let's say the first part of the COVID stuff. I mean, my concern and why I'm trying to make such a contribution, and I think everybody needs to, is, you know what, there's a lot of triathletes out there who, let's call them, you know, they're in and they're out. They might sort of like it, but if they found golf, if they found mountain biking, if they found paddleboarding or something else, they could disappear next year to a new activity that we've lost them to. So I think we need to continue to kind of keep that opportunity for them to be exposed to the sport, to have some fun. And that would be my biggest concern coming out of COVID, that if, you know, if you let a year or a second year go by and you don't keep athletes kind of inspired and connected, it's a chance that they find another interesting activity, take up golf or something else. So I think we all have a responsibility, if we love the sport, to kind of find ways to engage people, bring new people in. And we're doing that right now. We've got new people coming tomorrow from the race that I'm putting on at the subdivision in Alton. In terms of, you know, big picture looking back, I mean, I announced Cameron Brown's race in Muskoka in 1991. Cameron's now got to be like 46 or something.
I think
he's
getting on close to 50.
Yeah, and still winning, you know, races and certainly coming top 4 and 5 and 6, et cetera. So when I look historically, a few things happened. I mean, obviously the Olympic Games was massive. That suddenly turned countries that had never even heard of the sport. Suddenly their Olympic Federation was putting in money. You know, Portugal wasn't big in the sport many years ago. They've turned out great, you know, triathletes in Italy and others that really weren't in the sport. You know, initially, because of Les McDonald, who was the international president, there was a lot of Commonwealth nations and America. So, you know, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa all produced some great athletes. America, obviously. But then the Olympics exploded things. So there's no question that the Olympic Games exploded. And I think what it did was it produced a better quality athlete at the grassroots level. So these junior kids are doing things, you know, that people 20 years ago their mind would have been blown to see a junior being able to do 380 watts on a bike and, you know, swimming at 215 or so, 200, and then, you know, running 14 minutes and change, you know, that kind of stuff. So these times are there consistently, and those guys, you know, are moving eventually to whether it's Olympics, half Ironman, the full Ironman, longer distance stuff. So I think we just have a much bigger, broader pool of talented athletes. In my era, usually you were a one sport guy who picked up the other two to a certain level. So you were a great swimmer, you're Rob Burrell or somebody like that, or you're Mike Pigg, who was a biker, you know, go down the list. But now these guys at 14 and 15 and 16 are, you know, when you ask them what they are at 12, I'm a triathlete. I'm not a hockey player who did a one triathlon in the summer when I was 18 years of age or whatever. So there's a better skill set that's out there. The events certainly are at a much higher level of sophistication. There's more countries and more hours of television. So all of that is great. What I think is kind of that borderline, if you ask some of the pros from 30 years ago to today, is that there was more of that just kind of pioneer kind of, hey, let's go do a 220K bike and see what happens to our legs on Friday when we have to race, you know, that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of more pioneering type of things in both the equipment evolution of what that was happening. You know, most of the stuff that evolved was 25 to 30 years ago, disc wheels and all that kind of stuff really came, and triathlon pushed that edges. I'm not so sure that it's happening to the same evolution in the last kind of 5 or 8 years. I would say relatively there was better money in the sport 20 years ago than there is today. And so my biggest, let's say, disappointment is that I think you guys need to be better paid and that there should be bigger prize purses for how talented you are. Like with the talent of a Jackson or a Cody or a Lionel, or go down the list, you know, a Lucy Charles, a Daniela Reif. If you took away, you know, what some people are able to secure from direct sponsors, the prize purse should be dramatically higher. And so, you know, when Hy-Vee came along and made the $1 million race, that was fantastic. It was awesome. And it drove things. And, yeah, you know, I would like to challenge some more of those kinds of organizations to do that. And I can see Chris McCormack doing some of that. You know, he and his organization, the Super League stuff, they're pushing the envelope. They're making stuff kind of like it was 30 years ago. Hey, what if we alter this a bit, et cetera. So, I mean, I love the ITU. I've been involved with it since I was, you know, very young in the sport, announced and coached and been to every one of their world championships, every Olympics. And I love the fact that the mixed team relay is in. Like, I think that when people get exposed to that, their minds are going to get blown. Like right now, such a small number of people have ever really seen a mixed team race. Yeah. But you know, next year in Tokyo, when they see what that looks like, it's going to be awesome. So I think that I would like to see more revenue in the sport. And I don't think we've done a great job, whether it's race director, whether it's federation, of bringing in dollars, and they need to be driven, you know, into you guys as pros, because you guys are amazing. I mean, I know how hard you guys work. And, yeah, you know, if you looked at what a baseball player who's the 30th guy on a team gets for like sitting on his rear end and getting into, you know, five games in a year, their minds are blown when they see how hard you guys work on a regular daily basis. So for me, if I could switch, you know, snap my fingers and have anything happen, it would be more revenue for the athletes so that more can make a stable lifestyle for themselves and therefore be in the sport longer, inspire others, you know, in a bigger, longer way. Because there have been some great athletes that have had to come and go, Jasper Blake and others that I can name in the past, that, you know, really was around economics, not because they were burnt out or injured or didn't want to keep racing. They just needed to find another way to economically pay their bills.
Yeah. And I see how that's totally plausible. I mean, like at this point, if for, you know, a long course pro, let's say, and for ITU, I think it's even more stingy in terms of money. But if you're not, you know, top 15% in the field, you're going home negative, or you're maybe covering your costs, but you're not really making a living. So if you're top 10%, you can maybe make a living, but to make a living, have a family, you know, make a real, yeah, living that's a good living, you got to be top 2 or 3 or 4%, and that's really, really tough to do. So I think that's, you know, that's what the PTO is trying to do, and they're really trying to, they basically, their statement is just like yours. It's the triathletes are, pro triathletes do amazing things, they're incredible athletes, and they deserve a bigger, you know, a bigger payday and more recognition among the population. Like, I don't think people realize what a triathlete does, and you know,
well, the daily work, how talented, you know, I mean, I think if you look back at tennis or some of those sports that were really quite modest incomes 30 years ago, you know, they, like those guys were great tennis players in the old days, but they weren't well paid. And so between a group of athletes who came together and, but it, you know, I think it's a very strategic business plan. It's got to be well thought out. You've got to bring value to the shareholders, you know, the sponsors and various people that are involved. But when you look at how bright you guys are, you know, 1-2 university degrees on average, articulate men and women, the role models, world-class in every way. You know, I believe still in the sport as much as I did, you know, 40 years ago, and I see the opportunities that are there. I just think we need to harness them in a better way that we still are on the fringe. And some of that's just organization around, we need to bring some more money into the sport.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I hear you, and I'm working on it to try to start some cool things with racing this year as well. I mean, you've inspired me. We're trying to get together a race in September that you've already said that we could use your venue, and we're going to, I think like you said, everybody's got to contribute. And like the other thing that's happening now is you've got age group athletes who they, for one thing, they want to race. For another thing, there's no pro races. Like people love watching a pro race. People love getting excited about that. And you've got, you know, race directors like yourself, or you're not typically always a race director, but you're in that role now, but you've got those people who want to put on a race, but you know, the numbers have been cut down. And so we've got to get creative and we've got to find ways to kind of pool our resources to do something cool. But you've been, you know, I've learned a lot from just doing the series. It's changed my, you know, changed my mindset. If you want to get involved or go and race Barry's old school races, we'll put a link in the description to the website where you can go sign up, as long as they're not totally full for the summer, because I bet you they're high demand.
Because literally we just make our day longer. Instead of done at 10:30, 11 in the morning, we'll just keep rolling. I mean, the beauty is that we make small waves so that you are socially distanced. You know, everything's been kind of initially based on that number of 10 or under. And so, you know, our commitment is to keep things distanced, safe, fun, low priced, and you're there for the experience of kind of coming with 5 or 6 of your friends, and your wave is your wave. We've got some waves that actually have just in a family, like just mom, dad, and 4 of the kids are literally the wave. And what a great thing that is. So in 2 weeks on Friday the 21st, we're literally no cost going to put on like 3, 4, 5, 8, 9, 10 year olds. And just because I had to cancel my kids' steel race way back in May. And so this is our way of, you know, I've sent out an email to the various parents who were participated with the kids in the past. And like, all my pros are going to come for the day. We're shutting down the venue and we're going to be there like with a medal for your kids and let them cross underneath the gantry and get the picture. And that memory, but hopefully will kind of put some DNA into their system for another 12 months to say next summer, I'm going to be back doing 3 or 4 kids of steel races, whatever.
Nice. That's awesome. Oh, that's great, because you know, the kids love, it's so fun to watch kids races where they sprint out at 200% and then who can survive and the longest, and that'd be awesome. I might even try to see if I can sneak out to go watch that if there's space.
That would be great. I'll send you the information. Cool. But it's the way that everybody can contribute. You know, if I had picked the right parents genetically for DNA, I would have been trying to be a great athlete like you instead of the other side of the microphone and the race director hat. So, you know, this is the way that I can contribute. And, you know, with you and Cody and Taylor and the next generation, you know, obviously in the big picture, Tyler Mislichuk and Alexi and Maddie Sharp and Joanna Brown and, you know, all of those great athletes, Emily Kretz, Dami, you know, those kids are working hard. I know every day you guys are in, you know, doing what it takes to be world-class. And my guys, honestly, I think in the big picture, we'll look back and say the COVID year, as odd as it was the best year that ever happened to my group of athletes, because we haven't been on the road traveling. We haven't missed one day in the weight room. We haven't missed one swim. We haven't lost a bike that we had to sit for 3 days and wait for in Ecuador or you know, wherever we've all lost equipment around the world. And so I've said, look, while the rest of the world's disappointed and sitting on their bum doing nothing this summer, we're making headway technically, tactically, physically, and that'll pay dividends. Because as an athlete, you know, you only have so many summers before Father Time says, okay, now you're an age grouper. So my juniors, you know, I don't want them to lose a year that they're not making the progress to eventually kick your ass.
I would love to see that. And you know what? They have a good chance at it next week, because I haven't raced draft legal since 2017. I did one race. So we'll see if I still got it. But thanks so much for joining me, Barry. This has been amazing. And I'll be seeing you again soon, training at your quarry and racing. So thanks a lot.
Anytime you want to come up and swim or bring a friend, we'd love to see you.
Awesome. Well, I'll be there tomorrow.
Awesome.
Holy cow, Jack. So thanks for making that connection and bringing that interview together. Sorry I couldn't make the live version of that interview, but I really loved how you brought this full spectrum approach to the kind of inception of what Barry saw when he got involved, race directing. He's been there for Canadian Gold. He's been there for the highs and the lows. And I think the main thing is, like, this is coming full circle, like was mentioned, like, we're getting back to grassroots racing. You're a prime example right now. We're seeing like low-key races that have moderate prize purses to keep pros gainfully employed. It's not so much that for the age group masses yet, but it's more for just entertainment value. So that's what I'm talking about. It's really awesome for us. But I mean, I'm creating a gravel triathlon this weekend just for fun. And maybe that'll be the next thing. You never know. But anyways, great job, Jack. Great job, Barry. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, this is a guy who at the beginning, there was nothing in place. And he said it with his Kids of Steel race too. He went and, you know, he basically just went to look for partners and said, look, there's this Kids of Steel thing going on. And he didn't even have anything planned. And then it was like, oh yeah, you want to support it? Okay. And then a few days later, he puts on a Kids of Steel race with hundreds of kids. So sometimes you just have to kind of say, we're doing this, we're doing it the best way we can, and it's going to happen, and just go from there and make it happen. And that's what people are trying to do now with, like, go do this gravel race, man. You never know. This thing might take off and might become the next cool thing. And I'm hoping to make a race that's going to take off as well, along with some other pros, just put together a pro race and just say, look, sponsors, we're bringing in Canada's best pros. Let's do this. Let's make an awesome video production. Let's make it valuable. Let's make it safe. We can stay within the guidelines and just do it the best way we can. So stay tuned to social media for how you can support that if you like the idea. And let's hope that these things just keep moving forward in a positive way. I think we're on the right track here, fingers crossed, and we can start getting back to work a little bit.
Well, maybe. I mean, I live right near Boulder, and it seems like Justin and who else? Who did he race? Did you see that on Instagram over this past week? Was it Justin him and Tyler Messler. Butterfield? Yeah, him and Tyler Butterfield went head to head.
Oh, and outside in a real race.
Like that's what we need to start doing. Like I loved the tenacity to just be like, you know what, we got nothing to do. Let's just go race head to head on, you know, whatever, 3K, 50K, whatever. And I think that we're going to start seeing a lot more of that because we're all bored, but we're all. As a pro athlete, you have to have a little bit of an entrepreneurial mindset. So we're seeing people put things together, and you're doing the same thing over there in Canada. So hopefully you can get all the pro Canadians together to put on maybe like a Canadian pro-am, get a couple, like 10 pro Canadians, 10 really elite amateurs, and have a fun day. Like that's, I hope to see a lot more of that now. And maybe one day Ironman won't be the dominant force because we've got these fun things that are maybe run grassroots, and we're getting back to what matters.
Yeah, that's the thing I hope everybody brings out of this is you don't have to go to a giant Ironman race for it to be real. Make something in your freaking backyard that's five times cheaper, and you're still racing each other. You're still out there kicking your ass, trying to, you know, go as fast as you can. That's what triathlon's about, just pushing your boundaries. So that's what I'm going to do. And even if we get no money out of it, I'm going to do this freaking race and just race. Like that's what we do. And that's why I got back into it. Or that's why I got into the sport, you know, pretty heavily 10 years ish ago, because I didn't think about money. I was like, this is so cool, man. I can just go and crush myself and try to make up all that time I lost on the swim. It's going to be sweet.
Yeah. And now hopefully we're getting our swim back to where it was 6 to 8 months ago. Hopefully we're getting there again.
I think so. I think all the open water for me, having not swam in a pool since March, is actually quite beneficial. And although I don't think my, you know, pool times are going to quite be there, I think in the open water, I'll be right there. And I think that's the case for a lot of people. Like most people have at least done a lot more open water swimming than normal, even if they do have a pool.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you don't lose fitness. I mean, because power trumps everything when it comes to race day. You know, there's no beautiful swim prize when you get, there's no swim premiums for that. So just power and swimming straight and being able to draft, like that's what we need. But anyways, great episode. Hopefully we can bring on another stellar guest next week. We're not going to even mention the name because every time we do, they flake on us. So hopefully we'll get somebody else coming out and talk about something.
They flake on us and or we just don't plan well enough and or combination. So yeah, we're going to get that going, but it's going to be an awesome guest. Thanks for listening. This is the Real Triathlon Podcast with Nick Chase and maybe one day Garrick Lowen again. We'll see if he ever comes out of that old the old van tour.
All right. Well, thanks, Jack. And thank you, Barry. Peace. Ooh. Oot.
Oh, that was a good one.
I got ish to do. Flying through the sky in my parachute. Dancing on the couch like I'm Tommy Cruise. On a one-man mission trying to see it through.